introduction that we are very much pleased in particular to have a neighbor from Calgary to come and present his thoughts before us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that since there will be people coming and going for a little while, that perhaps I should sit down in order to be close to the microphone. Can you all hear me up there now? We heard this morning of the promise of petroleum development and the hope for great changes in the Arctic. And I would suggest it is the responsibility of each of us connected with that development to see that the changes are for the betterment of mankind generally, and particularly for those who are indigenous to the North. And I would agree with Mr. Whedon that for every operation, there is a plus and a minus sign, and it is not measurable entirely in dollars and cents. And perhaps one of our difficulties is that the dollar is the most usual and perhaps the most easy or the easiest method or unit for evaluation. In the next few minutes, I will attempt to evaluate the effect of petroleum development, that is, exploration, production, and transportation on Arctic ecology. If we look at a polar projection, and I hope the slides will come on. Very good. We can see the current areas of petroleum interest in the Arctic, and these include the Canadian Arctic Islands, the Western Arctic, the North Slope of Alaska, and the northern part of Western Siberia. The Arctic has no rigid definition. It has been correlated with such things as permafrost, the tree line, an isotherm, or some other environmental marker. My discussion today deals primarily with the Canadian Arctic, and particularly with that portion of it north of the Arctic Circle, and it makes use, by extrapolation, of some of the industry experience in the Canadian subarctic. It is important first to try and assess the potential extent of petroleum resources in the Arctic. Mr. J.C. Underhill at the Arctic Symposium in Montreal in March of this year estimated the potential reserves of the Canadian Arctic at 50 to 100 billion barrels of oil, and from 300 to 500 trillion cubic feet of gas. And I think these figures are not too far from those we heard from Mr. Gallagher this morning. I believe he had 105 billion barrels of oil. Most of the potential acreage is now held in reservation or lease, and according to the latest figures, this amounts to some 638,000 square miles. And about three-quarters of this, or 470,000 square miles, is on land, with the rest being offshore. The proportions of land and water acreage have little effect to those which have more and more effect on the ecology. Geological reconnaissance is usually the first exploratory venture. It will be very effective in the Arctic Islands, where there's little surficial cover, and bedrock is widely exposed. On the Canadian and the Alaska Arctic mainland, it will be restricted to the outcrop areas. Most of the work will be done by helicopter or light aircraft, and there will be no appreciable effect on Arctic ecology. Geophysical reconnaissance and detail follows. This involves moving men and equipment, first on widely spaced lines and later at closer intervals, to detail the most productive areas. This work can be done by helicopter, although this has proven to be very expensive. Tests are also underway this summer using air cushion vehicles. It is more common, however, to use either trucks, tractors and sleighs, or low ground pressure tracked vehicles. And these latter vehicles are now the most favored. Some of the geophysical work in the past has been done without due regard to the environment, and it has resulted in disturbance or destruction of the organic cover, and this results in subsidence in those areas where soil ice content is high. And I have a figure here which illustrates this in the area in the Canadian Arctic. If we could have the next slide, please. And you can see here a seismic line, or what has resulted from a seismic line due to the recession from melting. Now, there are several ways to combat this sort of thing. We can work in winter on the frozen ground and on the snow cover, and where low ground pressure tracked vehicles are used with a minimum or reasonable amount of care, the survey work can be done with no appreciable damage to the surface cover. And the next slide shows the, if you look on the horizon there, you can see a slight depression. And this is a seismic line that was run in winter using low ground pressure tracked vehicles. Now, economics favor, of course, a year-round operation, and hence industry is interested in improving the capability to work in summer. There are two obvious approaches. One is to try and develop vehicles which do not damage the surface. This may be a modification of the present tracks to a less aggressive grouser, or possibly the conversion to aircraft or air-supported vehicles. A second possibility is the use of some type of cover which will prevent the scuffed surface from melting and at the same time encourage natural growth and stabilization. Experiments are being carried out now in both in Canada and in Alaska on the methods of monitoring or restoring the tundra surface. And I think we have a few slides here of some work that's going on in the Tuck area and the Inuvik area in Canada. The next slide, please. This shows a test site near Tuktoyaktuk where we took some of the moss cover off, trying to match what would be a fairly serious disturbed tundra cover. And then we try various types of seeding. We have reflective covers. We have insulation and so on. And we're monitoring the effect of this in helping the tundra recover. We have the next slide, please. This is a close-up of a small plot that we have used sawdust, and you can see the failure in the middle where the sawdust was too thin, and the ice lens has melted out, showing the effect even under this kind of protection where there is high ice content in the soil. There are other areas, of course, where the disturbance of the soil seems to be beneficial. I think perhaps we can have the next slide. This shows a seismic line in the Fort McPherson area of northern Canada, and you can see the intense growth of grass that has come back up on the seismic line, and this will stand 3.5 feet high. Could we have the lights, please? Now, the damage to tundra terrain is not the only concern in conducting summer operation in some parts of the Arctic. For instance, a good portion of the Mackenzie Delta is a prime breeding ground for migratory waterfowl, and this must be protected from large-scale human intrusion during the nesting period. This factor, of course, is being recognized by industry. Geophysical exploration is followed by exploratory or wildcat drilling. Unfortunately, the odds do not favor discovery of oil at every wildcat, or even every 10 wildcats. And while we didn't plan it that way, we in Canada have already located several areas where there oil isn't, for Mr. Whedon's use. Thus, exploratory drilling is generally a one-shot effort, and transportation costs must be minimized, as must the cost of site preparation. Rigs and heavy equipment are founded on piles or on thick fills, with supplies and working space on a thinner fill. Unless there is trouble in drilling, a site of 3 to 4 acres is usually sufficient. And the next slide shows a well site at Tununuk in the Mackenzie Delta. And you can see the drill site there between the watercourses on the delta. Do we have the lights, please? Now, most of the exploratory drilling has been done in Canada, that is, in winter, because of easier transportation and better site conditions. Many of the earlier winter roads were prepared by bulldozing off the snow and much of the moss and traveling on the permafrost surface. The following subsidence and erosion has left obvious scars on the Arctic. It has been found quite practical, however, to travel on a road of snow and ice, which is built up on the undisturbed surface. And the costs are quite reasonable, and there is little or no damage to the tundra. Since the Arctic is an arid region, the snow cover may be light and late arriving, and this can delay the start of winter operations. Now, for a word about development installations, they're much more permanent, and roads to each location could usually be justified. In very difficult terrain, the general practice is to drill one vertical well and several slant holes from a single location. This approach will likely be taken in many areas of the Arctic, since there's a large saving in surface facilities, and it's understood that the present plans call for the development of Prudhoe Bay in this manner. Provided suitable fill materials are available, there will be no difficulty in building stable roads and well sites. The most readily available fill material will be found in thawed river or lake beds. Large quantities of material removed from these sources could disturb the existing ecological system, and this should be a matter of careful study as work progresses. Production facilities in the Arctic will be highly automated, and in fact, computer production control will almost certainly pay off. Every effort will be made to minimize the surface facilities, in particular the oil storage. The wells will be connected as directly and as simply as possible to the pipeline or shipping terminal. One of the problems will be how to handle the hot oil from the wells. Such pipelines cannot be ditched into the permafrost because of the resulting instability due to thawing, and it is likely that most flow lines will be insulated and laid on the surface or on piles. Terminal storage, although it will be minimized, will still require some very large tankage, and where this is founded by necessity on icy permafrost, very well-designed foundations will be required, since the oil produced at high rates will bring with it great quantities of heat. Such tanks must essentially be isolated from the permafrosts. Since there's some freedom in location of terminals, it may be possible, however, to locate most of the oil storage on gravel or on bedrock so that it will not be affected by thawing. Main trunk lines will also be carrying great quantities of heat in the oil, and they will have to be isolated from icy permafrost. They may be safely buried in low ice content gravel or sands or in bedrock. The Russian practice is to lay the lines on piles or on supports across the permafrost. And although there this practice has been restricted so far to gas lines, it is likely that it will be required in North America for the hot oil lines. The construction of major trunk lines in the Arctic will require the most resourceful engineering approaches. Only the larger lines will be economic, and this will require the heaviest pipe handling equipment available today, plus the hauling of hundreds of tons of pipe and equipment along the right-of-way. It may be possible to predict the tundra with granular fill and by working only in appropriate seasons. However, the logistics problems and work scheduling will be a challenge to Arctic planners. It is recognized by pipeliners that only a stable environment will support a large pipeline, and therefore studies are proceeding to this end. These are then the phases of oil development in the Arctic. Support will be provided by roads and airfields, camps and towns. And perhaps one of the most disturbing factors will be the increase in population, either permanent or transient, in remote areas in order to accomplish the scale of development contemplated. This will put pressure on the recreational areas such renewable resources as fishing and hunting. At the same time, however, there will be provided a challenge and an opportunity for improvement to the Arctic's most valuable resource, that is, its people. In summary, the 470,000 square miles of potential oil lands in the Canadian Arctic will require for its development, first, extensive geological reconnaissance, and most of this is already complete, reconnaissance and detailed geophysical surveys for a total of perhaps 150,000 miles, drilling of 700 to 1,400 exploratory and perhaps 6 to 12,000 development wells for petroleum, construction of 4,000 miles of access road and 4,000 miles of trunk road, based on our experience so far in Canada of about 1 mile of road per well, construction of 8,000 miles of gathering pipelines and many miles of large trunk lines to market or to marine terminals, and the construction of camps, towns, airfields, and support facilities for an additional population of perhaps 10,000 in the industry and in supporting services to it. To provide for this effort in Arctic Canada, the total area directly involved in petroleum development will be some 13,500 square miles, or approximately 3% of the potential oil lands. And I would suggest that similar percentages may be expected in the other parts of the Arctic. Thus, the effect on the total environment should be small. However, in the development areas where activity is concentrated, there will be a marked impact, and the long-term effects must be well understood. As Dr. Johnson told us, the ecology of the Arctic is in a very delicate balance. The life of plants and animals is in a precarious position. This is a particular concern, and it is recognized that even slight changes in the environment might trigger a chain reaction. The best safeguards will be provided by basic studies of the ecology, studies such as Dr. Johnson outlined for us just a few minutes ago. And it should include careful documentation of past experience. There's one Canadian example which could be cited, and this is the development of the Norman Wells Pool in 1943 to 45. This was a wartime venture, and the wells were drilled, pipelines and roads built, and large areas stripped for storage, without any great regard for the effect on the environment. For the first few years, there was an excess of water as the permafrost receded. However, there was very little erosion because of the thick organic cover in that particular area, and a new set of stable conditions soon emerged. Permafrost in this area usually recedes about 18 inches in undisturbed areas and to 8 to 10 feet depth in disturbed areas. Frozen soils in the top 20 feet average about 40% ice. There is now little evidence in the field of environmental change. Flow line, rights of way, well sites, and seismic lines have grown back with secondary cover. Such a return to stable condition will likely occur in most of the taiga areas, but it's not so likely to occur in, or so rapidly at least, in the tundra areas where there's less vegetation and probably a higher ice content in the soil. Unfortunately, there's little precedent here, but it might be profitable to review the dew-line sites to see if they would yield any helpful information. Now, research on these problems is underway at many centers and using many different approaches. Probably the most basic of the work is aimed at understanding the heat balance associated with man-made structures on or in permafrost, and in finding ways to prevent the deterioration of the permafrost. In the high Arctic, the passive method of construction will likely be favored. That is, the maintenance of permafrost and its use as a foundation material. Isolation of structures from permafrost by piles is old and is well known. It has been used, for example, in the founding of large Russian cities on permafrost. And we anticipate no new problems for the petroleum industry, except possibly in the sheer size of some of the structures which we will need. Roads, airfields, and other fill structures on permafrost do not present any new problems. The important factor is simply the retention of permafrost in its original frozen state. The heat balance problems are fairly well understood, and there should be little effect on the Arctic environment. Work directly on the tundra is not so well known or understood. The disastrous results caused by stripping moss cover by men and equipment, or perhaps by fire, are now being documented. I think we might look at one or two more slides now, if we could, please. This simply shows the technique of constructing a fill road on the undisturbed tundra, and this is to a well site in the Tuktoyaktuk area in Canada. Could we have the next slide, please? And this shows the result of a forest fire on tundra, and you can see that almost all of the organic cover has been burned off. We expect that there will be a serious melting of the unprotected soil here and the ice, and this is in the Inuvik area. Could we have the lights, please? It's perhaps worth noting that in the decade of 56 to 65, there were some 390,000 acres destroyed by fire each year in Canada. In most of these cases in the north, this damage was due to natural ignition, but certainly with the advent of more people and more action, more industry up there, the percentage of fires and the total number will be increased. We're also doing some work now in Canada to determine if it's possible to classify the ice content of soils by aerial photograph interpretation. This is an extension of the work that's been so successful in muskeg interpretation. There are other useful approaches which are being examined, and these include, first, the design, as I mentioned, the design of vehicles which can travel over tundra without damage, and this includes the air cushion vehicles, vehicles with soft and large tires, and those with the flat, smooth tracks. Secondly, there's means of isolating the vehicle from the ground by mats of plastic or of steel. And this has been tried, but so far it's proven to be very costly. And finally, the development of methods which promote rapid recovery of the damaged surface. And I mentioned the fact that plots have been set out both in Nuvik and Tuktoyaktuk to test this possibility. The production of oil contributes little to air or earth contamination. Products are piped, separated, and stored in closed vessels, and they arrive at markets with a minimum of handling. While it has been pointed out that relatively small areas will be directly used by the petroleum industry, it is of course recognized that any change is a further contribution of man's attack on his environment, and it's part of the trend, present-day trend, of bending the environment to man's use. However, the finding of petroleum will lower the cost of energy in the Arctic, and it should make it easier for man to live in the Arctic and possibly enable him to improve the renewable resources of the area. In North America, the petroleum industry has, by its own initiative and by government regulation, set a high level of standards for field operations. These standards will have to be maintained in the Arctic, and know-how will be developed to safely operate in this new and severe environment. In conclusion, one cannot but agree with Dr. McTaggart Cowan when he says, in the northern lands, the knowledge of the appropriate ecological facts is indispensable if we are to quickly recognize the alternative opportunities for resource development and the constraints within which we must conduct our activities. Here, even more than farther south, man will continue to live in the closest contact with the natural environment. His success will depend as much on the sophistication of his ecological knowledge as upon his technical competence to respond. And I was struck yesterday by a quotation from an excellent film that we saw over in the next building here called Nanuk of the North. There it said, the status of man is judged by what he has done with what he has. Surely the discovery of oil puts an even greater responsibility on each of us to properly handle this great resource for the benefit of all. Thank you.
Well, we must thank Mr. Hemstock for this very interesting and somewhat hopeful view of the developments as they are being carried on in northern Canada. We next turn to hear Mr. Charles Evans, Fish and Wildlife Administrator, who will talk about actual experience on the environmental effects of petroleum development in the Cook Inlet area.
I wonder if we could have the screen up for just a minute and I'll just raise the mic. Cook Inlet. One of my colleagues prepared this with so much pain and strain, I just have to show it. Actually, our experiences in Cook Inlet represent more or less of a microscopic view of what people are talking about mostly at this conference, which is overwhelming rapid development in the north. The Cook Inlet area has been under development for some 12 years now. That is intensive development. But it does give us where oil is loaded aboard tank ships for transshipment abroad and to the correction, the lower 48. Our main concern here has been the development of the industry through what we can term four phases, one being the exploratory or geophysical phase, part of which occurs on the water, where formerly explosive charges were used to determine the subsurface strata on which the geologists based their estimates of oil production. These charges are now generally replaced by less violent techniques, and there's very little concern at the present time as long as these techniques are followed. This is vibrocease or some sort of vibrator device. On shore, the general concern is with the movement of tracked vehicles across the terrain and the influence on the terrain from this movement. Then we have the drilling phase, in which we have not only the construction of roads and the influence on the drilling area itself, but also the potential for a certain amount of spilling. Then we have the production phase, in which we have had on the inlet a certain amount of spilling of oil in sometimes substantial quantities. Then we have the transportation phase, which involves the transportation of oil through pipelines, loading aboard ships, and the transshipment, which has led to difficulties in all three portions. We have had pipeline leaks and pipeline breaks. We've had spills at the terminal sites. We have had ballast pumping of not always so clean ballast, and we've had actually damaged tankers which have lost oil into the inlet. I'd like to show a few slides of what we see in Cook Inlet. Well, this is probably familiar to a number of people. This is a normal onshore drilling rig, nothing particularly spectacular, but this is the type of development that you can expect to see onshore in the Cook Inlet area. Next slide, please. This is a temporary drilling vessel, which is positioned over the prospective well, and drilling takes place from this. These are highly mobile. Drill one hole and go on to another. Next slide, please. And this is a somewhat more permanent jack-up rig, which can be positioned and held. It's a little easier to hold in position over a hole, and generally not quite so mobile in our experience. Next slide, please. Now this is the production platform, which there are now 13 producing oil and one producing gas in the Cook Inlet area. Each one of these is capable of producing from 32 wells. I understand that none of them are actually doing so. These represent, as we understand it, an investment of somewhere around $10 million apiece, and are a permanent aspect of the Cook Inlet scene. Next slide, please. This is the developed oil field on the Swanson River unit. This is shows a number of things. In particular, it shows a factor which will be discussed somewhat later, and this is the effect of a regulated development procedure. In other words, you find seeded areas, your pads are all cleaned up. These bare pads in the picture are producing wells. And generally,